All right, so welcome back to Friends of Flow. My name is Tess Judge Ellis.
And I'm Rebecca Porter.
And this is Andy Witters. And we have some guests with us today.
We do. We have Dawn Brew, who works in Children's OR, and Amos Shonrock, who's a longtime nurse and also in a tertiary care hospital. During our break, we got to talking about environmental issues, political issues in the OR, and Andrew, you have worked in the OR for a long time.
Yeah, that's right.
So what comes to your mind first?
So I spent 10 years in vascular and thoracic surgery, and there's a lot of, I think, employee risk and safety issues in the OR, right? And so I think that nurses give themselves certainly to the action of what we're doing for our patients. And so standing for long hours, you know, I've been stuck by a needle by another provider. It certainly wasn't deliberate, but there's actions that take place to help prevent those kinds of things from happening. And then when they do happen, what do we do? Well, I mean, there are usually institutional policies to follow. So I wanted to kind of get into that with our guests in their environments. What are some of the respective safety concerns that you guys have for yourself and for your team? We kind of talked about what happens with the patient, but let's be selfish for a moment and think about what happens to ourselves as nurses, you know? So go ahead, take it away.
So I've been stuck as well by a suture. Those sutures can be really small, and when you reload them, it gets a little tricky.
That's right.
They're small. I mean, working in the brain, I mean, I'm used to like really small, like what is it, 5-0? Do you know kids must have like 4-0?
So let's talk about just briefly. So I mean, so are we talking like a proline suture, or are we talking like bike rolls?
Well, we have
like
Neuralin.
So neurals are crazy small.
Yeah,
small.
They're pretty small. Yeah. Yeah.
So can you tell our listeners like how small they are then? Are we talking like 10-0 or 9-0?
We used our 4-0s.
Yeah.
Right. Do you wear microscopic glasses when you're doing surgery?
I do not. The surgeons do.
The loops,
they always tell me that I need them too, but I'm pretty young, so I have pretty good eyes still.
Good job, Don. Yeah.
But you bring up a great, so that's an interesting perspective, because there are some hospital institutions that will just say, well, you need this, we'll pay for it, it's expensive. It's like when an institution is responsible for buying lead for its employees, because you're exposed to radiation. So I feel that it's the institution's responsibility to provide those tools that are necessary to do your job. And so you mentioned loops. I mean, so eye strain is huge. I mean, after especially working with such small sutures,
right? And we have the lights down for the microscope,
right.
so it's even worse. Yeah.
Yeah. So in a way, as a nurse, like you're sacrificing your a little piece of yourself to make it work. You know, to make this go smoothly.
Right. So, it's all worth it, though.
Right. Yeah. Of course.
Right.
Of course.
Yeah. You're standing. I mean, there's a number of extrinsic factors in the OR. There's sound, there's light, there's loud noises, there's sometimes unpleasant odor, smell.
Of course.
You know,
even they have to go to the bathroom sometimes.
I was just going to say, standing there, we use the mantra like water in, water out for ourselves. So it's like, oh, I have a break. I didn't plan on going to the bathroom, but I should just go because I need to go or not.
Don't miss the opportunity.
But you really learn to, whether it's appropriate, shut that part of your brain off.
So how many hours are you consecutively at the table?
That could vary. I think the longest I've been in one room and not left it is probably like 10 or 11 hours.
Holy mackerel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
But everybody's in it together, right?
Right.
How does that go? You know, when it gets stressful, who keeps the equilibrium? How do you guys balance all of that stuff out to keep the atmosphere, the milieu, just for the patient and for the people who are the surgeons who are really in there doing that really exquisitely sensitive work?
I think if you have a tight-knit knit team who leads that change could be anybody and could rotate during that 10 hours. Like, okay, I'm kind of tuckered out. Like, it's your turn to be the cheerleader.
That must be fun to watch itself, you know, it's like a little concert, you know, of energy.
Mm-hmm. I love the term being the cheerleader because it must, after 8 or 9 or 10 hours in the OR, does it get to feel kind of draggy? And then things can go wrong in a blink of an eye.
Right. So the stamina is there and you just got to, okay, what are we
doing
today?
It's all about the chemistry.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Don, what's the longest you've been in OR room?
I think I've been scrubbed in for 8 hours total before without a break.
So. Right.
Holy mackerel. And then everything's all draped and you can't move. How do you keep your knees from... Do you just do some bends and stand on your tiptoes and stuff like that?
Usually we're on steps, so I kind of go up and down the steps when I can.
Calf raises.
Wow.
So and
that's
I think
a really unique thing that goes on in the OR is that physical demand of standing there focused. There might be some lulls, I suppose, in the OR when you can kind of like, you know, you're going to get a like 10 or 15 minutes while they're doing one specific thing. Right. And then you know, okay, the game's on. We got to focus.
Right. But there's always in the back of your mind, like the what ifs. So you can never turn yourself completely off. You've got to, you know, have a little bit of that guard about yourself.
Wow.
I think it's underappreciated how much communication goes on. I mean, I think being in the operating room, you communicate just because you do it and you know what needs to be done. But like, I think for someone who might be a floor nurse looking into the lens of what the world of OR nursing is like, there is a lot of communication that goes on that contributes to the safety of what's going on for that particular case, for that particular patient, in any particular moment. And you can turn that intensity sort of on and off like almost like a dial, you know, in the OR. That's how I think of it.
You really advocate for each other too. There's times that you end up spending more time in the OR with your coworkers and you do with your own family. I always find myself advocating for my anesthesia partners because a common joke in the OR is the surgeon is saying, anesthesia, anesthesia. And I'm like, he has a name. His name is Andy. Like, let's refer to him by his name. You know, and they're like, oh yeah. I'm like, they don't call you surgeon. They know your name. Let's be hospitable and remember that.
So can we talk about those communication moments? Because there are a lot of nonverbals. I mean, like you have a mask on, you have a hat on. I mean, a lot of your communication is done through you know, just looks. I mean, and so of course we might say like, well, I need a hemostat or a clamp or whatever. But can we talk about some of the methods of communication and how do you read like say frustrations or right. Can you speak to that just maybe just briefly?
When the surgeons are frustrated, I can always tell because they get the wide-eyed look.
Yeah, so. Right. Sure.
Right. Sure. There's a lot to be said for nonverbal communication, shoulder shrugs, undermining the sigh.
Right. Yes.
That sigh.
I would love if everybody in the OR had really thick eyebrows because that can tell you 100 different things depending on the look that they give you. So I can make or break your day.
Yeah. I gotcha. Yeah.
So who do you think is the most unsung hero in the surgical theater? Do you know? I mean, it takes a team. We talk about nursing, anesthesia, and the surgeon.
Right. I don't know.
I just feel like everyone works together for the patient. I don't think there's one that takes the lead like that.
I think the patient is the unsung hero.
Of course.
Probably. Yeah.
It takes a lot of courage to allow somebody to put a tube down your throat, turn you onto a machine,
to just go through the entire process,
right?
From pre-op to intra-op to post-op. I mean, and those are definitions that's been defined by AORN, I believe. But that whole process is indeed somewhat of a miracle when you stop and think about how many people enter in and out of this patient's experience.
Right.
It's and it's relatively quick when you think about a whole hospitalization. Like the majority of the people there that will be touching them, communicating with them, is in that that operating theater or in that perioperative experience.
Right. So I think about going back to the ethics part of what I do, people trust us. And right. So I think that they are the unsung hero because we as nurses have the implicit trust of all of our patients. And what does it take to trust a stranger that you've never met before? And we have these letters called RN behind our name.
Right.
When the public sees that, or we introduce ourselves as, "Hi, Mr. Smith, I'm your nurse today," that you can immediately sense their tension and their stress and their fear go down because they trust us.
Right.
I don't know that I could go ahead.
I just always think that as a nurse, as an OR nurse, we have a responsibility not only to our patients, but the society that we serve, because at some point in time, a majority of the population is going to be in an OR whether they like it or not, just statistically. And the other thing that I always consider is, and what I impart on students and new nurses, is that you need to understand and empathize and respect the fact that this person is relinquishing complete control of their body and being. That may be to you, like you may be the one thing they recognize. So always offering, for instance, to hold their hand, whether they ask for it or not. And I'm always surprised the number of individuals that, you know, this whole year of therapy and everything they had before doesn't become real until they're on the table and there's lights above their head and they're like, oh boy, I have no control over what's about to happen. So always offering that hand, always reassuring them that, hey, you know, this may seem like it's going to be a 10-minute nap for you. For us, it's going to be a couple hours. So I want you to focus on something calm, something relaxing, and we're going to focus on you. So let that be what we do for
That's
you.
A great holistic approach. I really like that,
That's
Amos.
Perfect.
So thanks again for being here, you guys. You know, we mentioned briefly, we kind of touched on some of the environmental factors. I want to go back to some of the biologic issues that exist as safety concerns while working in the OR. So we touched on sharps risks. We touched on lighting, sound. The idea of being sort of hyper focused and standing for long periods of time. But let's talk about radiation, for example. Let's also talk about what we're breathing in. Are the gas hazards? I think about the ortho procedures that I was exposed to in the OR, the methylmethacrylate, where if we had any pregnant women that were working in the OR, they had to be at least one OR away to prevent any exposure, to prevent the ideas, you know, decreasing the risk for exposure to their unborn baby. But what kind of things exist in your respective areas in the operating room?
So I think there are several examples of a pregnant woman who can't be in the operating room while they're doing certain things that come to mind. Chemotherapy is sometimes given. We have given antibiotic beads as well.
Right,
so. Right. And you had mentioned the bone cement that lets off like a gas as you mix it. And unfortunately, you've either got to position your face away from it because when you're scrubbed in, you can't touch your eyes, you can't touch your face. So you've got to bear with it. And it's kind of like having, if you could create an onion that gave off an odor of burning plastic, that's kind of what it's like to mix bone cement. And knowing that there's not much that you can do other than try and be as far away as possible from that.
And what is so, this again, bone cement?
It's bone cement. It's used to as a fixation device to aid in keeping, for instance, total joints in place. And it kind of hardens as it sets up. So it's a...
And they have to mix it right there in the OR?
You have to mix it just in time. It has an exothermic reaction, so not only does it let off gas, but it heats up as well.
So is that like when you go to the dentist and have a...
Kind of, but on a much larger scale.
Yeah. Who does... This is crazy that they even know about these things. Anyway, that's... So bone the gas...
Bone cement lets
bone
off a little
cement
gas
gives
or
off
vapor.
A gas that nurses right. are exposed to, everybody, and it's like onion... Right. Like a nasty kind of. Onion stuff in your eyes as it's mixed together.
Right.
And that may be potentially problematic for pregnant women.
Potentially. So okay. A standard is that you verbalize ahead of time, okay, I'm going to be mixing bone cement in 2 minutes. If anybody's pregnant or suspects to be pregnant, you can step out of the room.
So there's so speaking of the things that we're breathing in, this is, I'm gonna send a little love out to an author that I've enjoyed, Murray Roach, who wrote the book Stiff.
That's a really interesting book.
It's a really interesting book. So to sort of verbalize what it's about, I mean, it's about what happens to our bodies once we're deceased. So it's a very interesting read. But at one point in the book, she visits an operating room theater, and she describes burnt tissue, cauterized tissue, as smelling like steak. You know, and so first of all, like that's a really interesting analogy, right? that human tissue, you know, would smell like steak, but the idea of having to be around cauterized tissue is indeed a health risk. And so, what do you guys do in your environment to mitigate that?
Well, how did you know it was a problem? Like, did you know it? How did it become a problem? Was it learned? Or how did in your workplace did it become an issue, or how did you become interested in it?
Articles have been coming out since about the 80s discussing the risks and the health risks to breathing in the smoke plume that from the tissue that's been cauterized. I mean, there's just so many articles out there now that talk about how bad it is for you. They say, many articles reference this, but they say that 1 gram of tissue, or about the size of a penny, is equivalent to smoking 6 unfiltered cigarettes.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Right.
I mean, that's...
What did they do to cauterize? Like, what is a cautery? It's electric?
It's an energy-generating device that emits high heat and electricity at one single kind of pencil or pinpoint.
And so they do this instead of using a scalpel, or when
they use it
what
to
part
stop bleeding it? After they've.
It's
after
the bleed, and you know, right. I should know this because I mean, right. Whatever. And yeah, I'm in it, but the, but okay, so they use it to stop the bleeding, and that's
correct.
So do they use that all the time? Is it common practice all the time? Is it just with certain procedures? Is it a?
I would say probably 85%
of surgeries have
use
that.
A cautery
okay.
pencil of some sort.
Okay.
Or
wow.
Laser.
So it's used, and then like in the operating room, percentage?
It's ubiquitous. Like
yeah, it's
you have
all
suction,
the time.
You have cautery,
and
you
so,
have an anesthesia machine. It's
and
just
so
standard equipment.
Do they know that nurses had all these problems? They never smoked, and then they had, or nurses or surgeons or whoever, and then they had all this lung damage. Like because you know even in when I do like an assignment nurse practitioner, so when I do an assessment of somebody with COPD, mm-hmm. you know, or breathing problems, I wouldn't
right.
necessarily know to ask an OR nurse, you know, did you have an OR nursing background? So,
right. And some of the research has indicated that individuals over time, kind of like COPD, their body compensates, their lungs compensate, they're functioning at maybe a less level, but their body has learned to adapt.
During surgery, so Don, you said about the size of a penny. It's cauterized.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going on all the time?
So it depends on the case. A lot of the ortho cases have a lot of smoke because they go through more fatty tissue with their spine cases. Neurosurgery, we have quite a bit too. And, you know, sometimes they're using two cautery tips and they're just going at it. And
side by side. And
there's just so much smoke coming up.
So how did you get interested in this? How did you know about it?
When the first month that I started, my nurse manager brought out some pens and said, can you guys start using these evacuation pens? Because it's really for our health and for our future. And nobody brought it to the ORs and nobody really said anything. It was more of a let's do it the way we've always done it. And nobody said anything. About a year and a half later, I found an internship through my work, and I decided that we needed to work on getting this implemented better.
What's a pen? No, a smoke evacuation pen?
So the cautery pen. Is
it a special kind of pen, a cautery pen?
So it basically functions the same way, except it has a evacuation tubing around it, so it sucks it up while they're cauterizing.
Okay. Yeah.
Is it different to use than a regular cauterizing pen?
It works the same way, but I mean, it's a different brand, so it's going to feel different to them when they're using it, but it cauterizes the same.
Do you guys cauterize, or do nurses cauterize, or is it just a surgeon's job?
Just the surgeon's.
Okay.
Yeah.
But But you're standing right next to them.
Hell
right
yeah. I mean, yes, so. Of course. Mm-hmm. I just was curious about who's was doing, like if you guys jumped into that role at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everyone who's, I'm sorry, everyone who's everyone who's in the room is affected by the smoke.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The anesthesia, any students who happen to be in the room. I smell it out in the hallway from some of the orthopedic surgeons.
Right.
And I'm so affected from that.
It bellows outside the OR again. Mm-hmm. And the patient, if they're not intubated or, they can be exposed to it.
But anything with airflow that is in an airflow-based room, I mean, it's going to be exposed to everybody, no matter who's
I bet, does it reduce the smell when you use that type of pen?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. That must be definitely. Way more pleasant. We can tell.
There's a reason that the secretary out at the desk can smell the same thing you're smelling in the OR because it's creeping out.
Yeah. This sounds like a really stupid question. Cass, you're laughing. Why are you laughing at me? Where does the smoke go when you use that special pen?
So there's a machine. There's an extra machine that filters it. So right. We have to plug it into the machine as well as the cautery machine. So it's going through the machine, through all the filters that are small enough to grab all the particles.
Right. So if you could think of like a smoke vacuum cleaner, it keeps it and isolates it all in its own container.
Okay.
Unit.
And then I read somewhere in one of the articles that we will post on our with our website on this talk is that the air has to be fresh air has to be cycled through the OR at a minimum of three or sometimes four times per hour.
Right.
So how does that happen?
Even with that, so there has to be an air mixer. Usually it's about 15 to 20 cycles in an hour that you're replacing the volume of air in each OR. And it has to be a certain percentage of fresh air. And it's done through generators that usually are on the top of buildings or on the outside. But even with that said, that isn't enough to decrease the amount of potential hazard and plume smoke from lasers and energy generating devices.
So, we were talking about, has the institution adopted this or these special pens and what sort of regulations and how does that policy work get done?
So we don't currently have a policy on evacuating smoke from cautery. A lot of times we do evacuate for laser procedures. We just hold up a tube next to the laser while they're going. But we don't have a policy. Since I've started my internship, we started at about 2% usage with the smoke plume evacuators. And last month, we were at 35% in the children's operating rooms.
What steps did you take to get to that increased percent?
It was a lot of hard work. We did a lot of education with the nursing staff at the beginning. I talked to the surgeons in their meetings. We had the vendor rep come and support our rooms. He went to every room in the morning and asked if they were using the smoke plume evacuator because the operating room nurse, the circulator is doing so much. It's really at the back of their mind with the smoke plume evacuation because it's just easier to do it the way they always done. But it was good to have him in there helping set things up and plugging things into the new nurses who don't know how to use them because they never have. So he was a lot of help getting everything started, and it was a lot of talking to the surgeons about the cost and about the research that supports the health risks.
How expensive is it?
So it depends.
There could be an increased cost anywhere from an additional $15 per case, but that all depends on the product you're using, the volume that you buy, and the vendor that you're going with. But to be honest, in the grand scheme of things, for an OR budget, $15 is really nothing.
And the
there's suture that we open that's probably three times that cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
the filters are also an added cost to the smoke plume evacuators. They have to be changed out maybe once every 3 months, depending on how much you use them.
So I think that's a good point because I think that I think to some of the plastic surgeries like belt lipectomies before there was smoke evacuation available for some of the folks I was working with, a lot of smoke with that extra tissue and everything, but taking like the regular suction tube, right next to the cautery wasn't doing anything. Cause like it's not being filtered out. You're just going through like the suction device and that's just being recirculated in the air. So you truly need some kind of a filter, with, an evacuation.
Right. So, the filters with the normal section are not small enough to filter out those
exactly.
particles.
So, yeah, exactly. Yep. Right.
It's just going back into the air we're
yeah,
breathing.
So you're better off not even using the section.
Yeah.
The regular wall section.
Yeah, that was like an interesting like thing that you had mentioned about like just putting a, you know, a suction up to the cautery. And so, cause it doesn't really do anything, for the health of your lungs.
No, it's a psychosomatic false assurance.
Exactly.
That you're
doing it. Yeah, out of sight, out of mind.
Right.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Have you guys been able to, have the receptionists or the secretaries noticed decreased smell since you've started using? Has 35% reduced that?
So I haven't gotten the big users yet. So those orthopedic surgeons have not bought in yet. So
it's all about the stakeholders, isn't it? And it's about process change. I love that you're learning that as nurses. I mean, that's how we change things, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So how is the health of this OR staff being monitored? Are outcomes of pulmonary health being monitored of all of the OR staff?
Right. I don't know what they are. I mean, maybe anecdotally, it makes me think to, you had mentioned like radiology, Andy, and we wear lead. That's considered par for the course. Like you just always put lead on, and we even have dosimeters that you wear on the outside of your lead that are measured quarterly at least. Why isn't there something?
Are they really heavy, the lead things that you wear?
Because they come in different weights. But
at the dentist office, it's pretty heavy.
Right.
You have to wear all that in addition?
At times, yes.
Wow. That's another thing we didn't even talk about. Aren't I hot?
But we don't wear like a smoke plume badge to tell us how much you've been exposed to.
So maybe if you add pulmonary function tests as an outcome marker on your research.
No, or even just something that actually measures how much smoke have you been exposed to in the air, like an outward badge that you can clip on and wear.
Is there something like that?
I would think there's got to be some sort of air purity testing.
Let's
they test air quality elsewhere?
That's a great idea. You can wear it on your hat. So to all the nursing innovators out there, there's an idea for us right there.
There you go. Nurse innovators, are you listening?
Yeah.
How did you guys network with any other hospitals that are doing the same thing to see what they're doing? Or what do you know about what's going on around the country?
So we've talked to the AORN Go Clear Award people, and they have talked about what other hospitals have been doing and gave us some tips. But I mean, it's a really good program to be doing the Go Clear Award. We're going to shoot for the gold, but we have to have 100% usage to get that gold.
Yeah, talk about the AORN and what they've been doing as an organization a little bit.
Regarding this or other things, I mean, really,
I mean,
I guess I would say, what have they not been doing? They really are our leader. They create the dogma for OR nursing, and they are respected among other medical and nursing professions, especially within the perioperative setting. Surgeons will say, you know, if you're coming to them with an idea for process change or culture change, usually when you say, well, according to AORN, this is recommended, it catches their attention right away, and they're kind of like, oh. That means I can't really argue with this because the research has already been done. So, and is usually supported by their like organizations like the American College of Surgeons.
But changing culture is difficult in just about every aspect of, or every arena of nursing care. So I would tell all of our listeners to...
We've always done it that way, Andy.
Yeah, that's right.
The most dangerous words in healthcare.
So
you talk about your encouragement because I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, that's all right. Just keep your foot on the gas pedal, so to speak. You know, like don't give up just because you have a manager or an administrator that says that this can't be done, or they're giving you flack. I mean, look at it as a try to turn that negative experience into a positive one and learn from it.
Because Don, how did you come up with this idea, or did Amos talk to you about it, or?
So I came up with the idea, and I talked to leadership to make sure they were all on board, and they were more than willing to get it started, and they actually wanted to just push the gas pedal a little bit too hard. They wanted to just mandate and tell all the surgeons that they had to use the smoke plume evacuators.
Right.
But I mean, I feel I feel that we'll have more satisfaction with the employees if we do it this way, and we educate the surgeons and the nurses, and then we ask them to start using it before we just tell them they have to.
They'll figure out that it was really their idea,
right. And they always like options. So if there are options available, we like to give them those. So at least you may not have a choice on whether or not you use it, but you may have a choice on what you use. So.
Dawn, talk about your internship. That's and what made you interested in that?
Evidence-based program.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my internship is about 18 months long, and they spend the first 6 months about talking about how to look at research and how to get a synthesis of data and just really decide how to approach an issue. So I'm doing mine over the smoke plume evacuation, and there's other people in the hospital from ICU and from the units that are doing other projects, but, they also help with the, implementation as well. They said about 90% of the, internships, get published. So, I mean, it's a great program, and I've learned so much from them.
So about how far into being an RN before you, what would attracted you to it, and yeah, how far in? Yeah, you were already an RN, so, and then you just saw this, or what happened?
It's through my work. So we had to be an RN for at least 2 years, and my manager brought the internship to me and asked if I had any topics that I would like to research more. So,
how awesome. That's really great. It gets you excited about what you're doing, and you learn about how to implement change. So before we move on, Dawn, what does this, do you just do this on your own time, or how does this internship work?
So the hospital pays for 1 day out of every month for me to be out of staffing to work on my internship and work on implementation and anything that I need to. And they also pay for the time that I'm in the education with them, learning how
to
research.
So they pay your department.
They pay
the, time,
the unit.
Release
yep.
time. And that was the Department mm-hmm. of Nursing pays the surgery department or whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
Nice.
And then an expectation of my role as a quality and safety leader is to assist her with that whenever possible. So it's kind of a built-in expectation of other nursing leaders within the
internship kind of thing. Great.
So they're supported throughout.
So before we got started, we started talking about how to stand up for yourself in nursing when surgeons or physicians kind of get in your face a little bit or don't talk in a respectful way. And because you, Andy and Amos, are men, you found it easier to do that, or you notice things about women and such. So can we talk about that in our remaining few minutes that we have our guests here?
I would love to.
Sure.
Yeah. You go, guy.
Yeah. So where should we start with this? Because I think first off, I think like the phrase male nurse, it that just drives me crazy.
Agreed.
Ladies. I mean, 100%. It's something that is one of the few professions that we seem to denote the sex of someone before we say what their profession is. I mean, you don't say a male engineer. You don't say,
right.
So
true.
I've, okay.
I think you say female engineer.
Okay.
Nurses will stop saying male nurse.
Right. Okay. Right.
But it's just where our culture is at in denoting sex, like and how there's like this this uncomfortableness of what the role of nursing is. And I don't think that nursing is a feminine profession. I don't think there's anything feminine about taking care of someone.
No.
And a great example is in the ERs. I mean, we have these EMTs, which are sort of seen as these hero sort of roles, typically men. But when they get to the ER, who are they passing off their patient to? Usually it's a nurse and it's a woman, right? And typically that nurse who is a woman is typically thinking about 15 other things that's far beyond just the resuscitation or the IV flows of the patient. They're mm-hmm. and they're communicating with a whole other team of people. I mean, like, but yet they're almost demeaned in a way for their femininity, you know. And I think that's wrong. I think that's partly of the subjugation of women in nursing.
I think what you're saying is you admire the highly complex skill and planning and decision making, prioritizing, all of those things that have to happen in a nanosecond with expertise.
Yes.
And that is, you see no way, shape, or form that's just simply something that women should subjugate or put. But it's
not gender specific.
It's it's not gender specific. So that's where we should start. I don't think nursing is, I don't think it should be a gender specific thing. I think the history of nursing, though, is certainly has lent itself more towards
the historical underpinnings of it being a nursemaid or a female dominated profession. I mean, even if you look at the matriarch of the genesis of the name of this program, right? We look to Florence Nightingale. Mm-hmm. She's kind of the mother of modern nursing, but is there a male equivalent? I don't know.
No, huh?
Right.
And no, I think you'd have to look within like the church, you know, and see the the brothers and those people that gave themselves in care of people. And obviously in battle, there were male, the word male nurses, but men were mainly in battle and they were the medics and stuff like that. And so it probably was.
But those same actions are mm-hmm. seen completely differently through the culture and the context of of sex, you know? So a man in battle who's in uniform, who might be wearing a gun on his hip just because he saves his colleague, he's a hero.
Right.
Yeah. A woman who does that, who might do that exact same thing under a hospital tent in the field, is seen as, oh, just what a great caretaking person.
And so, but patriarchal society doesn't allow women to have that sort of out front capacity unless you are like at the side of or supporting the male role.
Right.
How does that also translate then into what it would be like to be a woman who is also a surgeon? And what did they have to do to be accepted into that historically male dominated
sure.
role? And I think that there are some comparisons. What are men in nursing doing to change the societal perception of what it is to be a nurse and the skill and expertise and knowledge and critical thinking that's involved? And then you look in surgery, and for women to be a surgeon, you know, you think, oh, well, what's she giving up? And she mustn't really be a real woman.
Well, that's a lot to unpack there. So that's a lot. So I would say that for a woman to step into like the surgical, I think that's great. I think that I've lived my life thinking that we should respect the merits of our skill and how we think and how we can exercise our skills, not based at all on our sex, our race, or whatever else, whatever sort of quantifier that makes us a person.
Right.
Now to get to to your original question is what it's like for men in nursing. And so, is it easier to talk to another male-based provider? I mean, I've learned to stand up for myself, perhaps a little easier than my female counterparts because of the constructs of our culture and the expectations in our society. I've had nursing female colleagues who say, "Well, you come into this profession with an automatic advantage being a guy."
Yeah.
I think that's true.
Yeah, I've tried whenever possible to use my male privilege to advocate or at least stick up for my female colleagues if they're indeed having the same problem with an individual.
Or to empower them to use their words and to articulate with the same kind of authority. Dawn, what are you thinking about this?
Because it is mainly women in the operating room for nursing, I've seen it go both ways. I've seen surgeons give more respect to women or more respect to men. I really think it depends on your work ethic and how well you're going to advocate for the patient and how well you're going to get what you need for the case.
I'm really glad that's your experience.
I'm glad
that is.
Yeah, that's
well said, Don. Thank you.
I've been involved in some instances where if I see someone, including patients, there, it might be yelling at my female colleagues. I'm not afraid to stand up and say, "Why are you yelling? Like right now? Like there's no reason why you should be yelling." Just call them out. And I've discovered like that's okay. It can be professionally done, and that's worked well for me. And, I think I have a reputation, at least in my practice, that if you see Andy come around, well, just button up, don't yell, be happy, be positive, be kind to the patients, be kind to each other. And that's how I've been kind of like my, a team sort of leader, for my group. But I like what you said about Amos, what you said about, advocating for, other nurses, just being a guy. Like, right. I think that's totally, an appropriate, expectation, and it's reasonable too.
Right. It's utilizing that label, whether we like it
right,
or not,
that label,
and the privilege that does come with it in the environment, depending on where you're in. There's opposite to that too. Like, oh, we need somebody to lift a patient. Well, go get that guy. He can help lift. I mean, so it cuts both ways, but I try and use it to the advantage of my colleagues and most importantly, the patient. So
exactly.
All right. I think this was a great podcast. So thanks for showing up to Friends of Flow.
Yeah.
Amos, Dawn, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Amos, and thank you, Dawn. It's been a great conversation today. Thank you.
All right, signing off. This is Tess Judge Ellis. Keep your eye on the patient.
This is Rebecca Porter. Be kind.
This is Andy Witters of Friends of Flow telling you to innovate, agitate, and educate.